officially welcome everyone to today's Clue and Internet Seminar. My name is Dallas, and I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be helping to moderate today's Clue and Seminar on closeout procedures for NCL sites training, which has been sponsored by the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovations Construction and Post-Construction Management Branch. Again, we're going to kick things off in just a minute, but while we wait a few extra seconds to let some latecomers join us, I'm going to cover some basic housekeeping items. As I mentioned throughout the reminder messages before we started today, each individual participant needs to have a copy of the presentation materials open in front of them. And again, I'm going to remind you, if you're on the phone lines, please place the phone on mute. You can use your own mute button or hit *6 to mute your telephone lines. And if you think you did that, go ahead and press *6 again, just to make sure. Again, when you registered for today's seminar, you would have been directed to the seminar homepage, which had a description for today's session, and that included not only a listing of the content that would be discussed, a link to the guidance document that actually is the focus of today's training, contact information for both of our presenters as well as myself, and there were options to download the presentation materials as either PowerPoint or PDF. So if you haven't done that, please go ahead and download a copy of that presentation material. And I'm going to ask everybody to move along from slide number 1, which is the title slide, onto slide number 2, which is our housekeeping slide. Again, I'm on slide number 2. And as hopefully I've just demonstrated, with each Clue and Internet seminar, participants will be required to manually move through the slides on their own based on verbal cues from our presenters. So I'm on slide number 2 for those of you who are just dialing in. If you are looking at the slides in an online browser, you'll see a series of numbered links that appear on the left slide. You can use those numbered links to jump through the materials at cues from our instructors. You can also use the icons that are located at the top of the slide in small orange buttons. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you back. For those of you on the telephone, we will have opportunities for you to ask questions out loud, and at that point you can take yourself off of mute using the *6 command. But until then, please remain muted. And if you haven't done so already, I would ask that you mute your telephone line using your own mute button or hitting *6. Mute your lines now. And I can hear side conversation now, so again, it's *6 to mute your line. Thanks. And I can still hear side conversation, so again, it's *6 to mute your phone line, please.
Okay, I'll yell, and you guys listen to see if you hear me.
And we can hear you. We can definitely hear you. So you want to undo whatever you did, hit *6, get your phone line.
Maybe you unmuted it by accident.
And hopefully you'll be able to mute your line, and I appreciate everyone working hard to make sure those lines are muted. Again, keep yourself muted until we get to that point for question and answers, and I'll remind you how to unmute if you need to do so. If you do need to, please don't place the call on hold. There might be background music or commercials that could be disruptive. There won't be any entry or exit tone, so you can simply hang up if you need to take another call and then dial back in whenever you can. So remember, stay on mute until we take breaks for questions, and then otherwise, feel free to come on and off the call, just making sure that you're muted. Those of you, though, that are streaming the audio online, you won't be asking questions out loud. Instead, what you will do is actually type up your questions electronically. As long as your pop-up box is disabled, you'll notice that there's a question mark icon that appears at the top of your slide. If you click that question mark icon, a new window will open up, which will allow you to type up a comment or question. And when we get to the breaks for Q&A, I will actually read the questions out loud to the presenters on your behalf. You can submit those electronic questions at any point in time, and in fact, I would encourage you to do that as soon as the question occurs to you, so you can have a nice queue of questions ready to go when we get to breaks for Q&A. As again, I indicated, you'll be manually moving through those slides. If you're joining us, I'm on slide number 2. Another reminder to everyone, this presentation is being recorded, and you will automatically receive an email in about 1 to 2 weeks from me as soon as that archive is available for free replay or download, and you're welcome to pass that email on to any coworkers or colleagues that you think will find it useful. Before we close out the session today, I'll provide two important links. One will be a link where you can download the slides as well as the guidance documents focus of today's training. The other link that I'll point you to is our short feedback form. And if you're looking to get credit or verification of your participation today, you want to be sure to hang tight until we get to that final slide when I'll provide instructions on how you can receive that information. So with that, I'm done with my reminders and my welcoming messages. So with that, I'm going to turn things over on to slide number 2, to our 2 presenters who are both coming to you from EPA's Construction and Post-Construction Management Branch. Jen and Kate, feel free to take it away.
All right, thank you. This is Jennifer Hovis in the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, Construction and Post-Construction Management Branch, and I will be covering the first 2 sections of this training, and then Kate Garufi, who's here with me, also a member of the same branch here at EPA headquarters, will be covering the second 2. We do recommend that you have a copy of the closeout procedures guidance for May 2011, either printed out or open in another window alongside you as we go through this training, because we will reference a few graphics and things like that along the way. So we're going to get started on slide 4 is the closeout procedures guidance outline. Jean, is that the same slide that you have listed as slide 4?
The letter has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes.
The leader? Disconnected?
I would continue.
Okay, we're going to continue. We're not sure about the technical problems that we're having. Slide 4 is an outline of the 5 major chapters of the closeout procedures guidance. The first chapter we're going to pretty much skip over. It's basically an introduction and mentions previous guidance that was superseded by this May 2011 revision. So the rest of the course today in the 3 hours, we will be touching on chapters 2 through 5. I will mention that this guidance does supersede the primary guidance previously was from January 2000, was the previous closeout procedures. We also had an addendum to that document in 2005 related to construction completion. Also, this guidance document does cover fund lead sites, enforcement lead sites, and federal facilities in the sense that all aspects that are common between those sites when achieving these milestones. But if we have specific questions as we go through the training that are very specific to federal facilities or enforcement, we may need to follow up on some of those questions or defer them to other program experts. So we are primarily going to be touching on the things that are common across all leads. Okay, as we go to the next slide, Chapter 5, we'll be introducing remedial action, Slide 6. This is basically an outline of the 4 major chapters we'll be talking about. First, we'll be talking about remedial action completion, and we are going to be talking about the definition and requirements for completion, and then also the contents and requirements for the remedial action report. Slide 7. So what is new about the 2011 version of this guidance document? The new guidance talks about the use of multiple remedial action projects at a single site, and this was done primarily to allow for the implementation of a new EPA Superfund program measure, which is called the Remedial Action Project Completion Measure. And so we added some new guidelines on the effective use of multiple remedial actions and basically carving up one Superfund site into multiple projects. We also talk we provide specific guidelines on the use or on the completion of multiple types of remedies. In the previous guidance, we had very general guidelines for RA completion, and in this one, we've actually laid out, based on the type of remedy or technology, what those completion requirements would be to try to be clear. And then also, the new guidance no longer distinguishes between the term interim and final RA report, which the previous guidance did, and we'll talk about that. Slide 8. So what is a remedial action? The definition in the guidance is actual construction or implementation of a discrete scope of activities supporting a Superfund site cleanup. Slide 9. Both operable units and remedial action projects are used at a site basically to subdivide the site into a series of smaller units to lead to more effective management. So distinguishing between the terminology operable unit and RA project, the OU is usually a geographical area or maybe one or more media or chronological phase of the cleanup versus the RA project, which really is the physical work that is carried out to address an OU. So I tend to think of it as the OU is kind of the noun and the project is the verb of the work that's being done. Terminology-wise, RA and RA project are synonymous terms. When we initially rolled out starting to use the term RA project, we encountered some confusion that maybe that was a subunit of a remedial action. So we just want to clarify that these terms are synonymous with one another. And a site may therefore have one or more operable units, certainly. Some sites have a very large number of operable units, and then each of those OUs may be addressed by one or more RA projects. Slide 10 is, this is the new section of the guidance that relates to using multiple remedial action projects to carry out a cleanup at a Superfund site, and basically dividing the site into operable units and then to further into RA projects is at the discretion of the region. It should be based on best professional judgment, analysis of both engineering and project management considerations to determine the most efficient and effective management of the site to conduct the overall site cleanup. There are several factors that may be considered, considering, duration of how long the site is going to take, whether different parties are conducting work in different areas, have we been denied access in some areas, and so we need to continue in separate areas while we wait to resolve those issues, things like that. And so the guidance lays out different considerations and just encourages that multiple projects certainly are very likely at a site, and these are the ways to think through what the best way is to do it at your site. So on slide 11, we have laid out an example site that we are actually going to follow throughout this entire training today so that we can emphasize in really detail how we're going to achieve the milestones covered in this guidance in relation to this example site. So just to do a quick overview of our example scenario, we are going to say that we have just one single site-wide rod, just to keep it simple. We have an operable unit 1 that refers to soil and an operable unit 2 that refers to groundwater. For soil, the rod selected a simple dig-and-haul remedy for that OU, and then for OU 2 in groundwater, we have in-situ chemical oxidation for the on-site plume, a restoration remedy, and then we have M&A for the dissolved phase off-site plume. And then we have institutional controls to limit well drilling and exposure to the drinking water. And so in this scenario, in terms of how we would likely divide this site up into multiple RA projects for effective management of the site, the most likely scenario we would see is an RA project for OU1 for all of the soil work as one project, and then a second project for the groundwater restoration work where we would likely combine the ISCO, and M&A into one remedial action project, and then the institutional controls would probably be a separate project if, say, this was a fund lead scenario, because it would likely be a different party carrying out that work, and we'll see how that unfolds. So that is laying out this initial scenario, and then we'll touch on at the end of each chapter how we're going to declare completion. Slide 12 is the definition of remedial action completion from the guidance. RA completion is achieved when the designated regional official, EPA regional official, branch chief or above typically, approves the remedial action report. That's a pretty simple definition for completion, basically signature of a report, but really what this guidance and training will teach you is that the determination that the work is complete and that the timing of the RA report is appropriate, that is really going to depend on what remedy is being implemented at your site. So while the definition of completion is simply the signature of the report, determining that it is the right time in the timeline of your site for that report is what this training is going to get into. The blue box, an easy thing to try to remember in your mind for RA completion. RA completion signifies that all of your cleanup levels have been achieved for the project that you're completing. except in the case of groundwater and surface water restoration remedies. So aside from restoration, you are only ready to document RA completion if you have achieved all of your cleanup levels. And we will get into why restoration remedies are different. On slide 13, we're going to quickly run through definitions of four other key terms that are related to RA completion. We're not going to get into these in great detail because we do have other guidance that touches on them, and also we have additional guidance forthcoming, hopefully, that will touch on them in more detail. But I'll do a quick overview of each of these terms just to help frame our conversation. So on slide 14, for operational and functional, ONF is a term that we primarily associate with fund lead remedies, though we do have an equivalent in federal facilities of operating properly and successfully, and we do encourage it at PRP lead sites. A remedy becomes ONF either 1 year after construction of that remedial action project is complete or when the remedy is determined concurrently by EPA and the state to be functioning properly and performing as designed. And it's typically whichever is earlier of these two criteria. ONF is so important to us in the program because for fund lead sites, it really is setting the schedule for when the state takes responsibility for ONM. If you have a containment remedy of groundwater or source material, as soon as the remedy is ONF, we'll be turning it over to the state. If you have restoration, then it will not transfer immediately. And so ONF isn't particularly important for fund lead sites. ONF should certainly be well documented. The guidance covers that. Really the SSC, Superfund State Contract, is the perfect tool to outline the expectations for making that ONF determination, including the specific criteria for the remedy that you're working with. Slide 15. Long-term response action is a term that refers strictly to fund-financed groundwater and surface water restoration remedies, and it is the 10-year period between the operational and functional determination and when operation and maintenance begins. It is considered basically an extension of the remedial action in terms of the funding arrangement between EPA and the state, where EPA will fund 90% of the LTRA activities and the state provides the 10% cost share. And really it's a hybrid where the funding arrangement is much like RA, but the activities that are happening during LTRA are really more routine operations that you would associate with ONM, so it's really a hybrid between the two. And this is a special arrangement only for fund lead restoration remedies. PRP lead restoration remedies, we have created the internal term PRPLR to associate with PRP lead restoration remedies. We do that primarily for our own kind of tracking and reporting purposes. And the 10-year time frame obviously does not apply in that situation, because there would be nothing to transfer to the state since it's a enforcement lead site. Slide 16 on operation and maintenance. ONM refers to the activities necessary to maintain the effectiveness and integrity of a remedy. For restoration remedies, it's referring to the continued operation of the remedy after that 10-year LTRA period is complete. And the important thing to remember with ONM is that EPA is statutorily prohibited from paying for ONM, and so ONM is only conducted by either the states or the PRPs. So if we move to slide 17, these are the four types of categories of remedial actions that the guidance specifically talks about and that we will talk about in the training today. We're going to step through each one and give a basic definition of the type of remedy, the criteria or guidelines for determining RA completion, and then we have a visual depiction of the pipeline to go with each one to hopefully help. And it's also important to recognize when looking at these that there is some overlap. We obviously have multiple goals and things happening within a remedy, and so there may obviously be some site-specific situations that are unique. If we move to slide 18 for source remediation, the term source remediation refers to actions that are taken to reduce or eliminate toxicity, mobility, or volume of contaminated source material. And typically, source remediation actions, these occur through on-site treatment or by physically removing waste from the site. And so you'll see some examples on this slide, dig and haul, soil vapor extraction, sediment dredging, or stabilization, solidification of contaminated waste material. Slide 19, these are the general guidelines for documenting or determining RA completion for source remediation actions. The first is that all construction activities associated with the RA are complete, including site restoration and demobilization. All RAOs and cleanup levels have been achieved for the action. A successful contract final inspection has been conducted, which we'll detail later, and that the RA report has been written, it's consistent with the guidance, and has been approved by the designated regional official. Those last two items, 3 and 4, they are consistent for all of the remedial action scenarios we're going to talk about, so I'm not going to repeat them each time as we go through. Slide 20. This is basically a visual depiction of the source remediation pipeline. In the guidance, if you're a visual person, I think these probably help you as they get increasingly more complicated as we go through the scenarios. There's also a very good table in the guidance if you're following along, Exhibit 2-1, that lays out each of these remedial scenarios and the general guidelines for completion. So this graphic basically depicts the pretty simplified scenario of source remediation with your remedial action and your RA report upon completion. There are some very limited instances where O&M may be necessary after a source remediation action. An example would be if you had on-site stabilization or solidification of waste. But since it's not quite as common, it's not depicted on the scenario, but it may happen. Moving into our next scenario for source and groundwater containment on slide 21, containment remedies may include permanent source control, landfill caps, or physical measures that are controlling the migration of contaminated groundwater. And slide 22 covers the guidelines for when RA completion would occur for containment remedies. We have similar criteria that all construction activities are complete of the containment system, including site restoration and demob. All RAOs have been achieved, so you have determined that containment has been effectively achieved at the site and that you've made an operational and functional determination for the system. And again, inspection and RA report. Next. Slide 23 is again the pipeline, which basically here shows that you have your remedial action of constructing the containment remedy. The O&F period is the last year or less of your remedial action phase where you have constructed the remedy and inspected it to start the O&F period, and then you have up to a year to document your O&F determination, and then you have your RA report, and your remedy will transfer into O&M. And that O&M, again, is funded by either the PRP or the state, not EPA. Slide 24 gets into groundwater and surface water restoration. These refer to remedies with the objective of returning all or part of the surface water body or groundwater aquifer to a beneficial use specified in the ROD. The most common scenario when we're talking about restoration remedies is restoring a current or potential drinking water aquifer to an MCL. And the timing for the RA report is unique for the restoration remedies. If you recall, at the beginning of this module, I mentioned that RA completion for all remedies except restoration remedies is when we have achieved cleanup goals. For restoration remedies, because the nature of groundwater restoration or surface water restoration has a much longer duration associated with the action, the RA completion of restoration actually occurs shortly after operational and functional. And so you are RA complete for restoration likely well before you have actually achieved your restoration objective. So if you move to slide 25, there's a little more detail here on RA completion will occur once you have constructed your treatment system. If you have an in-situ remedy, which is increasingly common for restoration, you will have initiated delivery of the appropriate reagent, and so you've begun injections, let's say, if you have an ISCO remedy. Your monitoring network is installed that you can effectively evaluate whether you have M&A or any other restoration remedy. You are operating as intended, so you have made an operational and functional determination, and again, you have your inspection and RA report. So slide 26 is the graphic for this more complicated scenario where you, again, have your construction phase in RA. Your operational and functional determination is the last year of that remedial action phase. After you have documented operational and functional and you have then done an RA report shortly thereafter, you are kicked into different scenarios based on who is funding your remedy. If you have a fund-financed groundwater surface water restoration remedy, you transfer into the long-term response action phase that we discussed earlier that would last up to 10 years. Or if you are either federal facility, you would transition into federal facility O&M, or if you have a PRP lead restoration remedy, you would have you would move into PRP LR. And so this graphic, if it shows appropriately on your screen, kind of split in the middle after RA completion. So on the top is your fund finance scenario, and down below is PRP or federal facility scenario. And so I just want to touch quickly on slide 27 on why we eliminated the distinction between interim and final RA reports. If you are familiar with the 2000 guidance version of the closeout procedures guidance, we had interim RA reports being used for restoration remedies. And the premise was that to document RA completion for restoration remedies, you would do an interim RA report because you had not achieved cleanup goals. That's why it was labeled interim. And then years down the line, when you did achieve your restoration goal, you would do a final RA report. In practice, even while that guidance was in place, the interim label was being used inconsistently. So some folks were using it for interim remedies. Some folks were using it for any pre-final version of an RA report. And so there was a lot of confusion in how the label was being used. And so this 2011 version of the guidance basically refers only to one RA report per project. The timing of that report has not changed. For restoration remedies, you still do that RA report shortly after ONF. It is simply now called an RA report rather than an interim RA report. And then in lieu of doing a final RA report, as we previously would have when you've achieved restoration goals, we now say that monitoring data that demonstrates achievement of the restoration goal can be used in the final closeout report, and we'll talk about that in one of the later sections of this training. And so we realize there are probably SSEs, enforcement documents, and things that reference interim and final RA reports, and that is fine. I think it's going to take a while for this to kind of work its way through the program, but it is our intention to move away from that terminology. Moving on to slide 28. We are going to talk briefly about institutional controls. I think most folks are aware, but I'll define ICs are non-engineered instruments, such as administrative and legal controls, that minimize potential exposure to contamination and or protect the integrity of a response action. Some examples folks are familiar with, I'm sure, zoning restrictions, well drilling prohibitions, easements, and things like that. RA completion for ICs gets a little more complicated because it may depend on, it will absolutely depend on how the RA project is defined in relation between ICs and the engineered component. The guidance accounts for three primary scenarios. There are probably countless other scenarios that could potentially happen, and so this is really a site-specific situation most commonly. The one main scenario would be where IC implementation, the party responsible for ICs is different than the party that is constructing the engineered remedy. For fund finance remedies, this is very common where EPA's contractor is building a pump and treat system, but either the state or the local government is responsible for implementing an IC to restrict groundwater consumption or well drilling. And in this scenario, we likely would not require implementation of the ICs in order to close out an RA with an RA report, because two different parties are doing this work, and one completion of the engineered remedy may not necessarily be directly related to the ICs. In the second scenario, ICs may be fully integrated with the engineered components of a single RA. This would depend on situations where the project was scoped that way from the beginning, because the two aspects are very closely related, or we have scoped the project a certain way in an enforcement agreement, for example. And in that scenario, RA completion would depend on the ICs being implemented first. And then in the third scenario, which is increasingly rare, ICs may be the sole remedy in a decision document, which we refer to in EPA as a limited remedial action. And in that scenario, RA completion absolutely would depend on the ICs being implemented, because the ICs there are the only remedial action. So there really are multiple scenarios there that probably get discussed on kind of a site-specific level. Moving to slide 30, we'll talk a little bit about inspections. The guidance talks about several different types of inspections that happen related to remedial action. EPA typically conducts pre-final and final inspections to determine whether construction was completed in accordance with the contract design and specifications. And so this is an inspection that typically is held between EPA as the contracting party and with the construction contractor. Other folks may certainly be included in that inspection. And really the purpose is to make sure that the contract requirements and design specs have been met. The pre-final inspection may generate a punch list of items that have to be completed before a final inspection is done, and then the final inspection confirms that all work has been completed in accordance with the contract. For fund lead projects in particular, we have a joint inspection with EPA and the state that initiates the operational and functional period. So that happens right as construction of the remedy is complete, and that inspection will kick off the start of the up to one year ONF period. And in most instances, that inspection to kick off ONF is going to be the same inspection that is the contract pre-final. In most instances, they are the same. And then for PRP and federal facility projects, these inspections are common, and then you may also certainly have specific inspections mentioned in your consent decrees, FFAs, and other enforcement documents. And so folks should certainly reference specific requirements for their sites there. Slide 31 talks about the preparation, approval, and distribution of the RA report. The report is typically prepared by the construction or the oversight contractor, which really is the party that is most knowledgeable on the very specific technical details of the construction of the RA and implementation of the RA. The goal is to have the draft report, or the final report, submitted to EPA within 90 days of the contract final inspection. And so the report really is only specific to the remedial project that's being documented. It really doesn't need a whole lot of detail on anything else that's happening at the site for context. And a lot of the site background, we hope, can be drafted in advance of the inspection, so that after the inspection it doesn't take too long to finalize the report. The timing of the report is becoming increasingly important to EPA, now that we have a program measure for RA completion. And so we'd like to do everything that we can to ensure that those RA reports are done in a timely manner. For the approval, there is no official headquarters review and concurrence role on RA reports. And they are typically approved by the branch chief or above in the region. They may just have a cover letter on top of them. It may be a signed memo or just approval line on top of the report from the EPA branch chief. And then in terms of distribution, copies should be submitted to key stakeholders like the state and others. And then you'll see throughout this guidance, there's a reference in the document about notifying natural resource trustees and that we do have commitments to send copies of documents documenting major site milestones to those trustees within a week of approval. Slide 32 is an outline of the guidance, and there is a more specific, much more detailed outline in the guidance document. For those of you that have it in front of you, Exhibit 2-5 in the closeout procedures has many helpful sub-bullets under each of these major sections in the document to help you with the RA report. A couple of things worth noting: that we did streamline the contents of the RA report when we revised this guidance last year. Two main areas that we removed were a section on lessons learned and a section on costs for the remedial action. And the main reason for that was because neither of those two items were directly related to the criteria and documentation of RA completion. We don't want to discourage folks documenting those things. They can be in an appendix or they can be separate in the site file, but we did not want, particularly for costs, to be delaying the RA report waiting on cost information. So you will see that difference. If a region by discretion wants to require those things, you know, that is acceptable. So on slide 33, we are going to revisit the site scenario that I laid out at the beginning of this module with our single site wide rod, and our two operable units. So to touch quickly on what would be RA completion for the projects in this scenario for the OU1 soil remedy, we would document RA completion after we had excavated and successfully removed all of the contaminated soil from the site, and that we had restored the site and completely demobilized, that we had done a successful contract final inspection to show that all of the work was complete, and then obviously once we had an RA report that's consistent with the guidance and signed by the appropriate official. And then for operable unit 2, for RA completion, we would likely document RA completion for the ISCO and the M&A in one project where we would begin injections for ISCO. We would have the monitoring wells in place for M&A, and once we could make an operational and functional determination that both of those were operating successfully, we would then do an RA report to close out the RA for the groundwater restoration remedy. If it's a fund lead site, that remedy would then transition into LTRA, and the injections for the ISCO would continue during LTRA. We would not typically do all of the injections for ISCO before declaring ONF. We typically would do one round, maybe two, to collect enough information for that ONF determination, close out the RA, and start that LTRA clock for fund finance sites. And then ISCO, which doesn't typically last 10 years, but if it did, we would have LTRA for 10 years, and we would transition into O&M for the M&A to continue if M&A had not yet been complete. And then the institutional controls would likely be a separate project as a local entity was implementing those ICs. So we will pause here for questions. I'll turn it over to Jean to facilitate the Q&A portion for the remedial action chapter.
Okay, great. Thank you. Sorry about that. I got disconnected, but it sounds like you guys have been able to move along smoothly. So I'm going to start with questions on slide number 34. I'm going to start with the telephone participants. If you have a question on the phone line, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting pound 6. We'd ask you to identify yourself or organization, and feel free to ask your question. Those of you listening online, I have a queue of questions. Continue to submit them electronically, and I'll switch over to those in just a minute. So those of you on the phone, feel free to unmute and ask your question.
Is it pound 6?
Well, you don't have to. Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
This is Holly Hadlock with EPA Region 9.
Sure, Holly, go ahead.
So I just noticed that slide 31 says that the RA report ideally should be done 90 days after the inspection.
Yeah.
But I noticed in the guidance, Exhibit 2-4 says you have up to a year for this O&F period. So I'm right now in the process of working on my statement of work, and, you know, should 90 days be my goal or, you know, up to a year?
That's a good question. The O&F period is 1 year from a basic inspection of that the remedy is constructed, and that would trigger the 1 year O&F period. The RA report would not come until after the operational and functional determination. So then it would be within 90 days after the O&F determination.
Okay,
so I can see how that was probably a little bit confusing, so I'm going to update my slides to have that make a little more sense. It would depend, I suppose, on exactly what the remedy was that was being implemented. The O&F period is up to a year. The 90 days for the report. The report has to follow the O&F determination. You can't do your RA report until after you have O&F, and so it would be 90 days after O&F.
Okay, yeah, the graphic didn't show the extra 90 days in there. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, great. Anybody else on the telephone lines have a question or comment?
Hi, this is Kelly Mannheimer, also in Region 9. I'm wondering if interim rods should be treated any differently with respect to the containment and restoration remedies. You know, for fund lead interim rods, so would it transfer within 1 year or 10 years, or is it any different, interim rods versus final rods?
Sure, Kelly, that's a good question. You know, right now our guidance really does not distinguish between interim and final remedies. There are a few weird places where things get mentioned. The LTRA 2003 fact sheet specifically says something along the lines of, if an interim remedy has a restoration goal, it gets an LTRA just like a final remedy, which is a little quirky because very few interim remedies have a restoration goal. And so we actually are working on guidance. There's a subsequent guidance to follow these closeout procedures that is a more comprehensive post-construction guidance document, and it is going to try to clarify some of these things in terms of, in general, the program's position is that interim remedies are treated the same as final remedies. They get an O&F determination. If they're containment, they transfer over. But we are going to try to clarify some of that in guidance that's pending that hopefully will be out this year. So.
Okay, great. Thank you. We'll take another question or comment from the phone line. Feel free to unmute and ask your question.
Hi, this is Mike. My question is, there was a joint guidance on recommended streamlined site closure and NPL for the deletion process back in 2006 between the DOD and the EPA. Is there a similar agreement between the two agencies for this document?
There is not. We coordinated this guidance document with the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office at EPA headquarters. And so it represents guidance for the entire program, but anything more specific than that for federal facilities, you guys should probably coordinate directly with CERFRO.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Another question or comment from the phone. Okay. I'm going to start then with the questions that have been submitted online, and this first one's coming in from San Francisco, California. And they ask, the certification of completion in a CD, can EPA issue the certification if there is a long-term, for example, in perpetuity O&M, for instance, cap maintenance?
Can you repeat that one more time, Jean? You broke up a little bit.
They ask in regards to the certification of completion in a CD, can EPA issue this certification if there is a long-term in perpetuity O&M, i.e. cap maintenance?
I am going to have to defer that question a bit to our enforcement folks. If the person that wrote it in wants to mention in their feedback so that we can get back to them, that would certainly be fine. There's a mention We touched slightly on certifications under consent decrees in the guidance in section 2.4.2, if you have it in front of you. We stopped short of creating a direct correlation between RA completion and certification of completion because certification of completion within consent decrees may have more requirements that go beyond just RA completion. So it really is specific to the enforcement document, and so I would defer the questioner to their enforcement attorneys, or if they want to follow up with me directly after this training, I can try to connect them to the person with the most specific answer. So I apologize for that.
No problem. Our next question is coming in from New York, and they ask, is the term, quote, PRP O&M, end quote, also used?
It is. It's not anything specifically defined. Operation and maintenance, you know, is basically the activities to ensure ongoing protectiveness of the remedy, and O&M that is funded by PRPs would be PRP O&M. There's no specific requirements to it that distinguishes it from, say, state lead O&M other than who is paying for it. So. The term PRPLR is a term that appears nowhere in CERCLA or the NCP. It actually was created for EPA internal guidance for our database tracking so that we know as a program how many restoration remedies we have so that we can gauge the endpoint of those remedies. And we needed to be able to distinguish PRPLR from traditional O&M.
So for tracking purposes for a PRP site that has a containment remedy, we would just call the operation and maintenance associated with that O&M like we would if a state was implementing it.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Our next question asks, what if the party that is supposed to be performing the O&M is actually doing very, very little? What recourse does EPA have? If the O&M party's efforts are de minimis, then how can EPA step forward to actively perform on-site work?
Wow, that's a good question. That probably deserves its own entire training course and dialogue. We don't get into O&M too much in this guidance and in this training, so I don't have too much time to answer the specific issue. I will say that we have separate guidance related to O&M that when we get to the very end of this training, one of the last couple slides has a few links to some key websites in the Superfund program with all of our post-construction guidance, and that O&M guidance material is there. And I think I mentioned earlier that we are working on additional post-construction guidance, and so we'll probably touch a bit on that. We do pay attention to O&M responsibilities and whether folks are doing what they're supposed to be as part of the five-year review process and other things. And so I think that we would work through those issues as they come up.
Yeah, generally we would use the enforcement mechanism, whether the state was doing the O&M under a fund lead scenario or the PRP was, if there was some issue with performance under those terms. But again, that's really document specific.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and they ask, do all OU responses need to be complete before the RA report can be written?
No, if I interpret that question to mean does an entire operable unit have to be complete for RA report, the answer would be no. So it really the emphasis on this new revised guidance is trying to separate linking RAs specifically to an operable unit. That an RA, there may very well be multiple RA projects at an OU across the site. And so determining RA completion is very specific to the project as it was scoped at the start of the remedial action. So however you scoped that RA project in the beginning, whether it's funds lead and you scoped it in your contract statement of work to your contractor, or it was scoped in an enforcement agreement with a PRP, that really is going to drive when you're complete. You do not need to be complete across an OU. You need to be complete as your project was defined at the beginning of the project. And then we will get into, as we go further in this guidance, rolling up across the site for construction completion and then site completion when everything does need to be complete.
Okay. Next question online. If EPA approved an interim RA report a number of years ago, will the, quote, interim, end quote, label be automatically removed, or does the region have to do something to remove the interim?
Oh, good question. Absolutely nothing needs to be done. That serves as a valid RA report that was consistent with guidance at the time, and there's nothing that needs to be done. We are just trying to simplify things as we go forward. So.
Okay, and our last question online, they ask, if ISCO injections prove to be ineffective, and then in parentheses they have reverse matrix diffusion with a question mark, can a new response action begin a new LTRA?
That would depend on many different factors. There is a document that is either from 2006 or 2007. I mix up two different things. That, again, is going to be on a web page. We'll show at the very end of the training. We have a policy that's referred to as, the title is something along the lines of recalculation of the LTRA transfer schedule between EPA and the states. And it does lay out instances where we would consider either granting a new LTRA period or recalculating the transfer date based on what has happened as a result of that remedy, and then instances where we wouldn't. That is, I'll say, an extremely site-specific situation. I know that's our answer to everything, but the policy itself actually requires that EPA regions come into headquarters for an official consultation, because those are pretty technical conversations that we have to evaluate whether the remedy that was in place, how effective was it, if it was not effective at all, would we consider a new restoration and a new LTRA period. So there is a document that covers that, and again, we will highlight it at the end of the training, the web link, so that folks can reference that.
Okay, great. That's the end of the questions that I have in the online queue. So I'm going to ask anyone who is on the phone, if you unmuted, to go ahead and unmute your line. So you want to be sure to use your own mute button or the star 6 command to remute. And then we'll continue on slide number 35. Those of you streaming the slide, or if you have any questions, you can continue to type them up electronically using that question mark icon. And we'll get to them at our next question.
Can you take another on-phone question?
Then, and that's, Kate, that's up to you guys.
Yeah, sure. We can take one more.
With respect to the OU1 example soil, would you do a final closeout report for that, or would you wait until OU1 and OU2 were ready for a final closeout report?
We will get to final closeout report, but the quick answer for now is that that applies to the entire site, and the entire site has to achieve cleanup goals. So it is not OU-specific. So we will get to that in two modules. All right, so we are going to move into the second part of our training, which is Chapter 3 of the guidance, on slide 36. So we'll be talking about construction completion now, and we are going to talk about the definition of accomplishment and how to document site-wide construction completion, and then also the requirements for the preliminary closeout report that is used to document CC. On slide 37, what's new about the 2011 guidance? There's not quite as much in this chapter that's new compared to the previous one. And we did add some additional details to clarify the CC criteria for in situ remedies. There was a 2005 addendum to the previous guidance that talked about this that we have rolled into this document, and then we did clarify a few things additionally there. We also have added a bit more information to this version of the document that clarifies routine anticipated adjustments that are acceptable after CC versus significant additional work that we would not want to be anticipating at the time of CC. And then similar to the RA report, as we just mentioned, we have removed the requirement for cost information from the PCORE as well. So on slide 38, what is construction completion? A CC site is a CERCLA site where physical construction of all cleanup actions is complete. That includes actions to address all immediate threats and to bring all long-term threats under control. The few important things to emphasize in this definition, construction completion is a site-wide milestone. It applies to all activities across the site. And also, it mentions bringing all long-term threats under control, meaning that no further construction is anticipated to address those threats, but cleanup goals do not actually have to be achieved at the time of construction completion. On slide 39, as a little bit of background on CC, it is an internal EPA measure and milestone that has no legal, financial, or contractual significance. It really is a milestone that we have used in the program for some time for outreach on progress at MPL sites. And so it was created as an interim measure to be able to demonstrate progress before sites are deleted from the MPL, in the sense that once we've constructed all work, work is continuing to operate at the sites prior to deletion, but that significant work at the site is obviously complete. It is a site-wide measure, and basically eligibility for construction completion is determined by your last response action at a site. And so as we go through this module today, we'll be applying kind of the CC criteria based on what would be your final action at the site. So at the end of 2011, for those of you that like statistics, we had completed 1,120 construction completions in the Superfund program on the MPL sites, and that's just a little over two-thirds of the sites on the MPL. The construction completion process on slide 40, basically you would conduct the pre-final inspection for your last RA at the site. So again, as we go through this and we talk eligibility, we are assuming in every scenario we talk about that we're talking about the last RA. So you have to basically achieve construction completion eligibility for all of the actions at your site. We're just going to simplify as we go through it and only talk as though we're talking about the last one. You would review the punch list items that come out of that pre-final inspection. Punch list items being minor modifications that don't really affect the functionality of the remedy. If you're looking at the guidance as you're going through this, if you look at Exhibit 3-1 of the guidance, there's a little box that has some examples of common punch list items. And then after the punch list, you would review the considerations that are laid out in this guidance document for the specific remedial technologies that are at your site for your last RA, and then you'll prepare your preliminary closeout report. As we talk through CC, we're going to talk primarily about the P-Corps. There are some limited instances where a final closeout report has been used to document CC. Most of those sites are removal-only sites, so they are not quite as common nowadays, so simplify things. We'll be talking only about the P-Corps in this scenario. Slide 41 basically just touches on the types of remedies and situations that are covered in the guidance, and we're going to go through each one of these in the next few slides. So moving on to slide 42, we'll talk about the first technology, which is groundwater treatment remedies. In order to achieve construction completion, assuming this is your last RA, basically you will need physical construction of the treatment plant, pumps, extraction wells, all complete at your site. The initial monitoring network, if you have M&A or even any other groundwater remedy, basically your initial network to effectively evaluate and monitor your groundwater remedy needs to be in place. You'll have conducted a pre-final inspection with only minimal punch list items remaining. Your treatment system is operational. You've turned it on. You've ensured that it is functioning. Any future adjustments to the treatment system are expected to be minimal. And then you have a P-Corps, and in it you should anticipate, you should identify the anticipated date of your operational and functional determination and a general estimated time frame to achieve cleanup goals. Those are generally rounded up, obviously, to far-out dates. So just to briefly mention, since we say here that the anticipated date of ONF should be in the P-Corps, so folks understand, you do not have to have achieved ONF at your last RA in order to get construction completion, because construction completion would occur close to the start of your one-year ONF determination, and you would not have to have made it all the way to the end of your ONF period. Slide 43, SVE as the next example we're going to talk about. It's very similar to an engineered groundwater remedy that we just mentioned. The extraction network and treatment unit have been constructed. Again, you've had a pre-final inspection with only minor punch list items remaining. The system is operational and adjustments are likely to be minimal. And then again, an anticipated ONF date and estimated time frame to achieve cleanup goals. This is a good point where it's also helpful to mention SVE is an example where the RA completion for an SVE remedy may lag pretty significantly behind CC. And so in a lot of ways, it's best in your mind to separate construction completion and RA completion entirely because they really very rarely align with one another in an easy way. And so if you remember from our previous module, SVE would not be RA complete until you've achieved your cleanup goals in the soil, but you will have achieved CC shortly after the system has been turned on and is operational. So. Slide 44. In situ remedies for groundwater and soil, this is the area in the guidance that we did add the most information since this is obviously an increasingly common type of remedial strategy. And so the important things to consider for construction completion of in situ remedies is that your full-scale remedy should be underway. If you are still in the pilot phase or treatability phase, certainly we would not consider you construction complete. You do need to have the full-scale remedy underway. Which is increasingly common, if you have phased implementation across the site, say you're doing some injections in the source area, and then depending on the reaction there, you are going to scope how many more phases you need to do in dissolved plume areas. The CC criteria apply in most instances to the first phase in that phased implementation. And so if you have three phases planned of ISCO injections, if you have begun the injections in your first phase, we would generally consider the CC criteria to be met. There may be some examples where that would not be the case, but that would be a site-specific determination. Physical construction of at least the first phase of the full-scale remedy should be complete. And so if you have injection wells and metering systems to install, those all need to be in place, again, for the first phase remedy. And then at least one round of treatment agent addition has been initiated. So I'm going to pause just for a minute to make sure folks can put their phones on mute. We are hearing some voices come through.
The Air Force already had it was a mess. But my understanding is,
I'm really sorry. We're just having another conversation, and I probably won't be able to get her attention. Let me try. If you're talking about the Air Force, we can hear you. You want to be sure to mute your phone line by using the *6 command.
Thank you, Jean. Okay, so let's see. I think we're on the third bullet. So there are situations where obviously with injection remedies, multiple rounds of injections are most commonly needed. And so as long as the first injection of the first round has been put in place, it's acceptable for construction completion. And then a pre-final inspection has been done to demonstrate the remedy will perform as designed, and again, future adjustments will be minimal. And so this, again, is also very different than the criteria for RA completion for ISCO, because again, it's ensuring that we have completed the construction, but that sometime later, cleanup goals would obviously be achieved. Moving on to slide 45, groundwater monitoring. The need for monitoring certainly does not preclude considering a site construction completion if it qualifies otherwise. Monitoring is considered, particularly because of the dynamic nature of groundwater remedies. We're well aware that the need for monitoring wells and placement of new monitoring wells is going to change as plumes change in size and nature. And so the installation of new monitoring wells is considered acceptable after construction completion. If we're talking about an M&A remedy, we do want to make sure that the initial network of monitoring wells is in place, because that really is your remedial action for an M&A, and we do want to make sure that those wells are in place. That is considered significant enough work for an M&A remedy that they need to be there prior to CC. And 46 on ICs, since institutional controls do not require physical construction, they do not need to be in place prior to construction completion. We do want them to be documented in a decision document prior to CC. We generally don't like to foresee decision documents after CC. We'll talk about that in a little more detail shortly. So we do want to be able to identify in the P-Corps that ICs have been documented in a decision document, what's the nature of them, who is going to be implementing them, and when, so that information is in the P-Corps, but again, they don't need to be in place at the time of CC.
Joel, and correct wrong,
I'm sorry, Jen. I'm going to actually go ahead and globally mute all the phone lines. I have a feeling that conversation's not going to end. When I globally mute the lines, you guys are going to hear a command, and Jen, and only Jen and Kate, should then locally unmute their lines. Everybody else should remain on that global mute.
Okay.
So if you guys hear the message of globally muted, please then locally unmute, and that only applies to Jen and Kate.
Jean, can you remind us how to unmute real quick?
You'll hear a message, but the command is #6.
All right. Thanks, Jean.
So to capture what we were hearing.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press #6.
Okay, so I globally muted those lines. Jen and Kate, again, it's #6, and go ahead and let me know when you're unmuted.
Okay, can you hear us, Jean?
We can. Thank you so much, and I'm sorry for that disruption.
No problem, not your fault. Thank you. Okay, so we were on slide 47 on interim remedies. Let me get back to my page. So interim remedies, we already had a question come up on them in RA. Most people are probably familiar that they are used to institute either temporary measures, sometimes early actions, basically used at a site while the final remedy is being developed. The most common scenario that we typically see is an interim remedy for groundwater containment while we're doing work to determine whether groundwater restoration is viable. Is a pretty common scenario. Interim remedies are limited in scope, usually, and they will only apply to a part of the site in an action that will absolutely be subsequently addressed by a final ROD. So an interim remedy doesn't hang out there forever. It will be followed by a final ROD. In order for a site to qualify as a construction completion, all interim remedies do have to be finalized, and then that final remedy does have to be implemented. So we will not declare construction completion at a site that doesn't have its final remedy in place. Moving on to 48 on contingency remedies, this is something that definitely comes up pretty commonly in terms of questions we get. We will consider a site that has a contingency remedy in its ROD to BCC when the region has information at the site to determine that we don't anticipate invoking that contingency remedy. We don't require, you know, any ESD or anything like that to say that. We just want to make sure that there is comfort, enough comfort with the site data to know that we don't anticipate. A common scenario is that we have selected M&A with a pump and treat contingency. Obviously, pump and treat would require physical construction, and so we would not document CC at that site until we could rule out the need to construct that pump and treat system. And so in the P-Corps, there needs to be a simple statement that we have sufficient information to not anticipate that contingency. Now, because CC is not any sort of legal determination, it doesn't preclude us from invoking the contingency later if it's required, but again, we want to make the best decision we can and not declare CC until we can comfortably say we don't anticipate it. Slide 49 and the following will touch on different considerations for CC based on lead and authority at a site. For PRP lead sites, the CC determination should not affect any enforcement agreement or other obligations with PRPs because it is strictly an internal EPA milestone for the site. The criteria for PRP lead and then moving down to federal facilities, the criteria for federal facilities are identical for CC as they are for our fund lead sites. The issue worth mentioning on federal facilities is that we beefed up some language in the guidance this time around that we really do want to encourage that the EPA RPM develops the P-Corps for the federal facilities. We understand that obviously federal facility sites are significantly larger and more complex than a lot of our private sites, but we do not want the giant P-Corps that we've had over the years, some of them many hundreds of pages and binders long. We really would like to emphasize that the P-Corps is a concise document, and so there is some new language in the guidance on that. On slide 50, a few other scenarios related to lead and authority. We do have some sites, in particular states, that are entirely state lead. And in those instances, we look for the state to prepare the preliminary closeout report, and the EPA would then concur with that document, and we would declare construction completion. If the state does not prepare a P-Corps, is not willing to prepare a P-Corps, then we do need the EPA RPM to do so, because we do require a P-Corps for every construction completion site. So we would look to the state to do that, but if not, the EPA RPM needs to be prepared to do so. MPL sites addressed by removal. If we have a site that has a combination of removal and remedial actions, there's nothing special in terms of requirements. It just means that both types of response actions should be described in the P-Corps, and we would make sure that all physical construction under either removal or remedial authority is complete. We do have a few instances, probably more so previously than we do more recently, where sites are addressed entirely by removal. In those instances, construction completion may be documented in a final closeout report after the poll rep has been done, because if things were addressed entirely by removal, we likely have achieved all cleanup goals at the end of that removal, and we would actually be ready for site completion, not just construction completion, and Kate will touch on site completion after this module. And then in instances where we have multiple authorities, our CC criteria apply only to CERCLA response actions. So if there is work being done at a site because it's an operating facility and work is being done under other authorities, basically CC will apply to any CERCLA response action documented in a CERCLA decision document. And so those are the remedies that we would look to make sure that they were construction complete before we declare CC. On slide 51, we have, in certain circumstances, there are some sites that were deleted from the MPL in the past based upon deferral to the RCRA program, and because at the time of deletion, physical construction was not actually completed because the work was going to be done under the RCRA program, we actually have a few sites on the MPL that were deleted prior to construction completion. So this slide refers to a very small number of sites, but for those of you that are affected by it, hopefully it's helpful that there may be some instances where CC would follow, because basically even though those sites are deleted, once physical work under all authorities is complete, we would then declare them CC. This is a little different than the prior slide where I said CC only applies to CERCLA work. This is a small subset of sites that are excluded from that because they were deleted based upon deferring them to RCRA and only RCRA. Slide 52 talks about additional work at CC. So we get a lot of questions and work through a lot of site issues based on, you know, if I still expect XYZ to happen, is my P-Corps premature? So there's multiple kind of circumstances that we look at when we answer that question. Routine adjustments that are reasonably expected in the lifespan of a remedy, repairs, cap maintenance, new monitoring wells, routine activities that happen during O&M, those do not preclude construction completion because we expect them, obviously, in the nature of the work that we do. If at the time that we are trying to discuss CC, we know that substantial construction may be needed, or we think that it may be because we're still doing some characterization, headquarters would obviously say that CC is premature and we should hold off on that PCOR. So these are instances where even though we just thought we were done, we suddenly discover that we have a new source area, or maybe we just found 1,4-dioxane and we hadn't previously been looking for it. We would want to do all of the evaluation we needed on that work, determine whether future work was needed before we would document CC. Now, obviously, there are situations that we have declared CC to the best of our judgment on based on everything that we know, and then stuff happens. Sites get hit by hurricanes and things like that, and so new physical work is needed after we declared a construction completion. Headquarters likes to monitor these situations so that we know about them. We have not ever in the program removed a site from the list of construction completions. We do, in the guidance, retain the right to do so, even though we never have. But basically, headquarters likes to monitor. We like for the regions to tell us when substantial work is planned after CC, just so that we're aware of the situation. The next couple slides will touch on the PCOR in terms of documentation requirements. For preparation, the PCOR is typically prepared by the EPA RPM. It's a pretty brief document. For those of you that have already written one, you know that. If you never have, hopefully you're not too scared then. We typically say 7 to 9 pages for private sites, up to 20, maybe a little longer for federal facilities, but again, we're not looking for 500 pages for a federal facilities PCOR. The PCOR, a lot of the background information in it can be taken from other documents so that it's not too labor-intensive to write, and it can be prepared prior to the RA report for the final RA project, again, in situations like SVE and such where the remedial action is going to operate for some time after CC. Approval for PCORs, there are some specific requirements, very different than RA completion in terms of the headquarters role. So EPA headquarters has regional coordinators within the branch that Kate and I both work in that I think the EPA regional folks on the line are well aware that we review all draft PCORs and assess the eligibility of the site for CC as we are reviewing the draft. And we're monitoring these sites during the year as well to determine eligibility. It usually doesn't come down to the first draft of the PCOR that we see. We will submit comments back to the RPM on the document, ask any questions we have that call into question the CC eligibility, and then we like to see the final draft back that incorporates our edits to the document, because we want to make sure headquarters concurrence is required on construction completion before we take official credit. And so the best way to go about doing that is to make sure that we see the final draft before the region routes it into signature by the Superfund division director. And so this does get signed at the DD level typically. Once the document has been signed, it needs to be sent to us with the signature so that we see that. And then headquarters actually enters into our CERCLIS database, the EPA tracking system for those of you that are outside EPA, and we make the official determination then that a site has achieved CC. If it takes a few days for whatever reason for us to get that document, it will be backdated. The CC determination does align with the date of signature. All right, slide 54. Again, the guidance has significantly more detail than what we're going to go into in this training course on the contents of the document. So if you have the guidance in front of you, Exhibit 3-2 in the document has the outline for what goes into each of these sections. And it is a site-wide document, so obviously it covers all removal and remedial actions that happen at the site. We want to document that we have had QA/QC procedures in place so that we are confident in the work that was performed. And then there is a schedule of activities for site completion where we would want to outline the implementation of ICs, the ONF determination for any remedies that have not yet had one, and then the first or next five-year review that's anticipated at the site, and the anticipated date of achieving cleanup goals and moving towards site completion. Okay, last slide for CC. Slide 55, we will revisit our little site example from our first module. In order to declare construction completion at this site, we will need to have excavated and disposed of all of the soil at OU1, and if there was presumably backfilling involved, we would need to have completed that backfilling. We would not have to have completely restored the site and demobilized, so that's a little bit of a distinction between RA completion and CC. For groundwater, we will need to have put in our initial monitoring wells, constructed the first phase of injection points, and started our initial injections for ISCO. And then ICs would not need to have been in place prior to the PCOR, but we would want to mention them in the PCOR in terms of what's planned and who is responsible for doing that. So there is definitely a distinction between RA completion and CC. In a lot of ways, the bar for CC is higher in the sense that it is a site-wide measure. All actions need to be built. But in a sense, the bar is a little lower, if you could say that, because punch list items are acceptable. We do not have to have achieved cleanup goals across the site. So I will stop there, and we will pause for questions again on construction completion.
Okay, great. Thank you. I have a couple of questions in the online queue, but before I turn to those, I'm going to go ahead and ask those of you on the phone lines, if you have a question, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting #6, and then feel free to identify yourself and organization to ask your question or comment. Okay, I don't see anybody on the phone line, so I'm going to start with those electronic questions. I'm going to start with the two short ones, and then we're going to go back to a very lengthy question that was asked just a little bit once after you started into this section.
Okay.
So this first question is coming in from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and it's in reference to slide number 46. And they state that on slide 46, in parentheses, IC, do the IC mention at the decision document have to be specific or just a general mention of what's needed? Example, do we need X township to issue an ordinance versus we need restrictions on groundwater wells, regardless of where it comes from?
That's a good question. In general, I would say that our decision documents, our general requirements for documenting ICs and decision documents in the program currently is that we would like the ICs to be as specific as possible in the decision documents. And I think at the time of CC, we would work through with the region what was in the decision document. Is the decision document clear enough? If an ESD or something needed to be done in order to clarify the ICs, I'm not saying one way or another whether that would be necessary, but if it was determined that it would be necessary, we would have a policy debate on whether that ESD would be necessary prior to CC. So we would like the decision document to be as clear as possible. If it's very general in the decision document, we would talk through whether or not we'd be okay with that. We probably would be, but we would be encouraging the region to be as specific as possible.
Okay. And, this is Kate, and I'll speak to that a little bit in site completion, too. So.
Okay, great. Our next question comes in from Georgia, and they ask, does vertical and horizontal delineation for groundwater need to be completed prior to a CC determination for a pump and treat or containment remedy?
does all delineation need to be complete prior to construction completion?
That's a good question.
In an ideal world, you know, that it's a good question. We don't lay things out in those terms. I mean, we would like to see that, obviously, we would have as much delineation of a plume as possible in order to design and construct a remedy, know where to place our extraction wells. There's certainly an understanding that with groundwater remedies and the general dynamic nature of groundwater remediation that plumes are going to shift and characterization is going to continue with the monitoring as a groundwater remedy operates. So we don't ask within the realm of CC criteria that you state that you have fully delineated the plume, but there's an understanding that, you know, we have enough information that we know we built and we designed and built a remedy that's effective to address our contamination. So there's an understanding that we have a very good sense of the delineation. Do you have any additional?
I think Jen covered that well. One of the things, you know, as our sophistication of groundwater, I guess, remediation knowledge increases and the subsurface is more understood now, there's a higher bar that's set at the time of remedy selection for groundwater remedies. Back in the early days of the program, we used to see a lot of interim actions followed by final actions. Then sort of in the middle of the program, we were seeing a lot of, you know, rush to get to final groundwater restoration actions without perhaps fully delineating. We're now seeing that there's another shift going towards interim remedies for groundwater if there's not a relative certainty that the remedy that's selected is going to, you know, we don't have the delineation and characterization to support a final selection for a groundwater remedy. So I would say we would like to see that. It's not necessarily a criteria, but the front end of our pipeline and the rod selection area is setting a higher bar where we are seeing more information now at the time of CC than we did previously. Is that a roundabout answer?
No, that's great. Thank you. I'm going to go into this longer question that was submitted online. And so bear with me as I read the entire question. It's about a paragraph or so long. Okay? Their question asks, how should the following activities be reported? And they then follow it with this paragraph description. At this site, the first OU was a residential cleanup that was, quote, cleaned up in 2008. An RA report was submitted at that time. However, when the five-year review report was done in 2009, it identified a number of residential properties that had not been tested or cleaned up. EPA had been denied access. Headquarters recommended that the ICs be applied to those properties. The region has decided that since it's been 6 years since the last cleanup activities, and there are many new property owners, that before the region applies ICs to those properties, it would give the property owners one last chance to have their property tested and or cleaned up. The region will be doing the sampling this summer and then cleaning up the properties next summer. Headquarters has approved the budget for these additional cleanup activities as, quote, ongoing RA. My question is, where and how do I document these additional RA activities when an RA report and PCOR has already been finalized?
Okay. So the gist I got from that was that we did a residential cleanup. We thought we were done. We now know that we have new areas to go back to, and we may or may not have some access issues related to those new areas. If the site is already CC, then that's not too affected by this. That falls into that category of we would want to know that this is happening at headquarters in case we ever get inquiries on how much construction is happening at CC sites. We want to make sure that we can answer those questions. But it wouldn't necessarily, unless we decided to, it wouldn't necessarily change the CC status of the site. For the remedial action work, it sounds like, I'm assuming this is a pretty specific question, so I'm assuming it's coming in from an EPA person, that it sounds like we have already agreed to provide funding as an ongoing remedial action, which means that we would still need, when we are done with the work, to document it in an RA report, whether or not we give credit for the action as a remedial action would be a discussion that we would probably have specifically with the region, based on the determination that it's an ongoing action. I don't want to bog this down too much because there's an awful lot of non-EPA people on the phone that won't want to hear all these details about coding something as an anomaly in CERCLA. So I would say that we headquarters should follow up with the folks that asked this question to get into the issues of documenting it and then determining whether we give credit for it, since it sounds like it's a continuation of a previous action. I will touch on another unique aspect of this question. I don't know if they were asking about this, but I will touch on it because it is a question that comes up, which is the issue of access. When we have large-scale residential areas, for example, where we are looking at hundreds of individual property owners and trying to get access to dig up residential yards, for example, and we are trying to determine construction completion or remedial action completion for a remedy or an RA project, our general guidelines on that are that we have to ensure that we have done due diligence of multiple rounds of contacting people, giving people ample opportunity to either deny us access or remain silent, but that we know that we have given multiple rounds of effort to gain access, and then we will hit a point where it is no longer cost-effective if we have been repeatedly denied access, and it is no longer cost-effective for us to stay mobilized at the site, and that we've done our due diligence to get access from these people, we will demob and grant RA completion or construction completion. Obviously, if the property changes hands or we continue to try to get access, we will absolutely go back out and do that work, but we will not continually hold up completion of our milestones because of it, as long as we can document sufficiently to headquarters a level of expectation that we have done the work and tried ample times. So that has come up recently.
Okay, great. I think you got that whole thing. Thank you so much. We had another question that came in from Sacramento, California, and this is sort of related to what you were just answering. They asked, if a site has achieved CC, but a later ROD amendment is prepared to change or enhance the current remedy, does an RA report need to be completed following the construction and implementation of the new remedy?
Yes. Yeah. Whether or not a site is CC will have no bearing on whether, you know, future documentation of work. You know, I would hope that in that situation we did not foresee the additional work coming at the time that we declared CC, but obviously things change. We have new work. We would have to scope that remedial action, conduct the work, and then document completion of that work with an RA report. So RA report requirements and completion requirements don't go away just because the site is CC. Because as Kate is going to touch on in the next chapter, we need to document the completion of all of our actions before we can ultimately move on to site completion and deletion from the MTL.
Okay. Well, one last check to see if anybody on the phone line has a question. Again, it's #6 to unmute, so you can identify yourself and organization and ask your question. Okay. Then in the interest of time, I'm going to resume the presentation on slide number 57. Those of you streaming audio can continue to type up your questions electronically, and we'll get to them at the next break.
Okay. Slide, this is Kate, so we're switching voice gears here for everyone on the phone. I'm going to be doing Chapter 4, Site Completion, and Chapter 5, Deletion. So on slide 58, as you can see, we are halfway home. I'm going to talk about site completion, which is a site-wide determination that no further response is anticipated, and I'm going to talk about the requirements for the final closeout report. So on to slide 59, what's new about the 2011 guidance that's different from the 2000 closeout procedures? First of all, there's a more detailed site completion criteria. The 2000 guidance really just said that site completion was determined when the site was considered to be protective and ICs were in place. It was really generic, wasn't very descriptive, and as a result, we had many issues with trying to figure out consistency across all 10 regions when determining that a site was complete and met site completion criteria. We also enhanced the final closeout report contents. The second bullet on the slide talks about a section in the F-Corps that discusses confirmatory sampling results for source remediation and containment activities. From when Jen was talking about RA completion, this is really going to be the section in a final closeout report where you take information from the RA report for all your containment or source remediation reports and document that the cleanup goals associated with those activities have been complete and reference the monitoring results. One of the other things that Jen said in the RA section in the beginning of this training was that we got rid of the final RA report for groundwater and surface water restoration remedies, which in theory was supposed to be written at the time that the cleanup goals had been achieved. When we were reaching cleanup goals for these remedies, generally they were either being operated by the PRPs or the states, and we weren't consistently getting RA reports. Therefore, instead of doing the RA report, we decided to add a section to the final closeout report that discussed the cleanup goals for those long-term surface water, groundwater restoration actions, and then also summarized the monitoring results that supported that you had met the cleanup goals for those restoration activities and append the O&M report or whatever document this comes out of to the final closeout report. So that's different from the 2000 guidance. Next slide, slide 60. What is site completion? Very simple definition. It's the end of all response actions at an MPL site. And response actions, by definition, are all removal and remedial actions that are taken at a site to achieve the remedial action objectives and associated cleanup goals documented in a decision document. So next slide, which is slide 61, what are the site completion criteria? We've developed three criteria here. The first one, all remedial decision documents have been completed and the selected remedy is consistent with CERCLA, NCP, and EPA policy and guidance. The second is all response actions have been completed and appropriately documented. And finally, institutional controls are in place. In the next couple slides, we're sort of going to go over the nuances of these three bullets. So we'll go on to slide 62. So here is our first criteria, which is a very loaded sentence, so we'll sort of break it down and talk about what we mean by this sentence. So the first part of it says all remedial decision documents have been completed. So in general, when we look at a site at the time of site completion, we want to see that all the response activities that have taken place at the site have either been chosen and or evaluated in a remedial decision document. So that sort of goes down to the second bullet, which says that if it were a perfect world, all the remedial actions that we had taken at a site would have been selected in a ROD, implemented by the appropriate party, and reached our cleanup goals. At some sites that are on the MPL, we see that cleanup actions are taken under another authority. The most common scenario for this bullet is when we put sites on the MPL, and perhaps through some agreement with the state cleanup program, which is not a CERCLA program, but maybe a CERCLA-like program, has taken the lead, maybe done a consent decree with a PRP, and have implemented response activities. What this bullet suggests here, and what we in headquarters sort of hold as a bar, is that if a cleanup was taken under a state program that is not CERCLA, but CERCLA-like, in order to meet a site completion criteria and show that it is protective and no further response is appropriate, we would like to evaluate the activities taken under that state authority, put them through the ROD process, evaluate them through the 9 criteria, and show that what in fact was done was protective. And in some cases, if you have containment activities like a landfill cap that were done under these other authorities, by writing a no further action record of decision in these cases, We can then put in our CERCLA five-year review requirements and also the operation and maintenance to ensure that the remedy that was implemented will continue to be protective after documenting site completion. The third bullet is when looking at a site when we get a final closeout report in and it's met the site completion milestone, we review whether the response actions adequately address all contamination and exposure pathways identified during the remedial investigation or any subsequent site characterization. As we all know, a lot of sites that we have that are still on the MPL have some decision documents that were written in the 80s or the 90s, and as I alluded to before when we were talking about groundwater, for example, the knowledge of the of groundwater remediation in general and characterization has increased, so that in effect can change our site dynamics and characterization. So perhaps some remedies that we had chosen earlier may not address all pathways or contamination. For example, we may have a pump and treat in place where we didn't investigate Dean Apple, so we may see if in fact we've addressed all the source material. Another example would be if we have a containment activity and had not evaluated the vapor intrusion pathway and we have volatile organics on site, we would want to see that the region or the PRP had adequately evaluated that pathway and ensured it was not an issue before we documented site completion. And another bullet, which is the last one, is that the remedy decisions are consistent with EPA policy and guidance. And I have two examples under here, groundwater remedies and institutional controls. I'm going to hit on groundwater remedies here. Recently, we've had a lot of policies that have come out on groundwater restoration and the expectations that have been laid out in the NCP and the expectations as we interpret them under CERCLA. So if we look at a record of decision that chooses a groundwater remedy, for instance, if we choose a landfill cap, and we chose long-term monitoring for the groundwater, and that groundwater is considered a current or future drinking water aquifer, we would want to see monitoring data that showed that the groundwater was below MCLs outside the landfill unit boundary before we met the site completion criteria, because under the NCP and our interpretation of groundwater restoration and protectiveness, if it is current or future drinking water aquifer, it is not considered protective and response actions are not considered complete until we've achieved that type of MCL cleanup level, whether or not it was chosen in the decision document. So we look at the decision, we look at the media, and we ensure that the levels in those media based on their current and future uses are consistent with EPA policy and guidance and the requirements. So that's really a first bullet and a very loaded bullet, and I'm sure people will have questions, but I'll hold those to the end. Okay, the second criteria is that all response actions have been completed and appropriately documented in the site file. This says that documentation containing defensible and reportable data to verify cleanup levels associated with the actions have been achieved. As we said before, for source containment, groundwater containment, or source remediation actions, generally there will be confirmatory sampling as a section in the remedial action report, so this information is readily available. For removals, it would be in a pole rep, and for groundwater restoration activities, we would want to see that groundwater MCL for the contaminants of concern have been achieved in that groundwater and documented in an operation and maintenance report or a sampling report. All right, and the last bullet is that institutional controls are in place. As a rule of thumb, all ICs must be implemented before site completion. As a rule of thumb, if there's waste left in place on site that prohibits unlimited use without restriction, in general, it is anticipated that an institutional control would be needed to prevent a certain type of use. So if we have a site that is going to need an operation and maintenance component in perpetuity, one would assume that an institutional control would be needed to prevent unacceptable use of either a groundwater media or soil. Also, one of EPA's requirements is any institutional control that's required for long-term protectiveness, again, as we said before, well restrictions, excavation restrictions, et cetera, must be documented in a CERCLA decision document. there was a question at, I think, during the CC, which talked about the level of detail required in a record of decision for institutional controls. When looking at site, when I look at site completion and subsequently deletion, which we'll talk about later, and I look at institutional controls in a ROD, I would say in general we're a little more flexible in the back end of the pipeline than I think the folks that review records of decision now are. Since some of the RODs were written 20 plus years ago, the sophistication of language for institutional controls wasn't really required. So what we're really looking for in records of decision or ESDs or wherever your IC is documented is to state in the decision document that the institutional controls required and to specify why it's required and what type of use it's restricting. If it doesn't say what type of vehicle is being used, we generally will not require a decision document modification. What we really want to see is that the institutional control requirements, restriction of groundwater use, restriction of digging, is specified in the record of decision. Next slide, slide 65. So how does operation and maintenance activities play into site completion? So operation and maintenance activities can continue after a site has achieved the remedial action objectives and cleanup levels. Generally, if it relates to maintaining engineering or ICs at a site where you have some sort of containment component, whether you have source containment such as a landfill or you have some sort of groundwater containment activity and you're going to need operation and maintenance in perpetuity, O&M can happen after site completion. If you have a site that has O&M activities that's being performed by the responsible parties or the state that are being conducted in an effort to move towards meeting remedial action objectives that haven't yet, so this would be a groundwater restoration or surface water restoration, a monitored natural recovery of sediments, until you meet those remedial action objectives and cleanup levels, that type of O&M is occurring, but your site does not meet the site completion criteria. So if your operation and maintenance is to maintain a remedial action objective that has already been met, such as a containment objective, versus O&M that is moving towards an objective that is yet to be reached, that's sort of the distinction between what type of O&M is appropriate after site completion versus the type of O&M that's being done that makes site completion premature. I hope that wasn't confusing. Okay. Slide 66. So what exactly is in a final closeout report? A final closeout report, the author of the final closeout report is similar to the author for the preliminary closeout report. We generally prefer to have EPA write these reports because we'd really like them, the body of the report, not necessarily the appendices, to be brief. So I would recommend that EPA write these. All the information for these reports can be found in your remedial action reports, your records of decision, and the O&M reports. As I alluded to before, as you see on this slide, there's generally an introduction that states that EPA, in consultation with PRP, the state, et cetera, believe that the site completion requirements have been met. Section 2 is a summary of the site conditions that talks about your records of decision, your basis for taking action, talks about your remedial design, your remedial action, and any activities that were taken before the site completion. Section 3 is your monitoring results. Those monitoring results are going to speak to the confirmatory sampling that demonstrates either your containment objectives have been met or your source remediation objectives have been met. And then attainment of groundwater restoration cleanup levels would be a brief discussion of the data that was collected in order to demonstrate that the restoration objective and cleanup levels for those contaminants have been met. After that, there's a summary of operation and maintenance, and in this Section 5, what we're looking for is a summary of the operation and maintenance that's going to continue after this site completion demonstration. So if you had operation and maintenance associated with cleaning up groundwater, once you've cleaned up groundwater, that operation and maintenance, in theory, is not going to continue. So that type of activities would not be in this section. It would only be compliance monitoring of groundwater outside of a landfill, landfill cap maintenance, et cetera. then the rest of the sections are pretty straightforward. Demonstration of cleanup activities, five-year reviews. You're going to talk about the last five-year review, what the findings were, the next five-year review, and whether or not five-year reviews continue to be required at a site. And then finally, site completion criteria and a bibliography. Again, one of the things, as I said before, since we got rid of the final REA report for groundwater and surface water restoration remedies, if there is a groundwater restoration component at the site where you're writing your final closeout report, we're going to want to see documentation appended to the F-Corps that shows monitoring results to support your restoration demonstration. So 567, this is sort of similar to the slides for the RA report and the P-Corps. As I said before, typically the RPM prepares the final closeout report. It may be a little bit longer than the P-Corps just because it has to incorporate all the activities that have happened since the system was constructed, so any optimizations, et cetera, that have happened, any documentation for confirmatory sampling and or restoration objectives being met. EPA headquarters, regional coordinators, the same that review your P-Corps, will be reviewing the F-Corps, and they will assess the F-Corps to ensure that the site completion criteria have been met. Headquarters does not have an approval, formal approval like they do for P-Corps on F-Corps, but it's recommended that the region work with headquarters to resolve any issues at the F-Corps milestone because the F-Corps plays heavily into the deletion, and headquarters has a heavy role in the deletion moving forward via a concurrence requirement. So it is recommended that for EPA folks on the phone, when sending your final closeout report to headquarters, I would make sure that you work with the appropriate regional coordinator to ensure that everything is crystal clear and that your site completion criteria are met. And like the distribution of the other documents, these are retained in the original site file, submitted to stakeholders, and the national trustees are notified within a week after the signature. So, we are on slide 68, so this is the last time that we will revisit our training scenario since we are at site completion. So, a single site-wide ROD, again, since the F-Corps and site completion is a site-wide milestone, we would have one final closeout report. In that final closeout report, there would be a brief discussion of the activities that were undertaken in the RD and RA for both the soil and groundwater remedies. There would be a section that would talk about monitoring results, which would talk about confirmatory sampling done after the excavation and off-site disposal to show that the soils were cleaned up to the levels that were specified in the record of decision. And for the groundwater remedy for the in-situ chemical oxidation and the monitor natural attenuation, there's going to be a section for the groundwater restoration results in the F-Corps that should have O&M or sampling report documentation that the groundwater plume, both on-site and off-site, had achieved the MCLs for the contaminants of concern in the record of decision. And also the institutional controls we would like to see in the final closeout report that they are indeed in place. They are appropriate to restrict or limit the well drilling as specified here in this record of decision, and that they are effective. So, on slide 69, I am done with the site completion, so I'll take any questions, Jean.
Okay, great. I'm going to start with the phone line participants. If you're on the telephone and you have a question, feel free to hit #6 to locally unmute your line and identify yourself and organization to ask your question. And remember, if you use your own mute button, you may have to turn that off and then locally unmute with the #6 command. Okay. I don't hear anybody coming in on the phone line, but I do have a few electronic questions that were submitted online. And the first one's coming in from New York, and they ask, is a five-year review considered an EPA decision document?
Short answer, no.
Okay. And the next question, this is also coming in from EPA, but they didn't specify their location. And they ask, how does one move an O&M site to the F-Corps stage when there is residual groundwater contamination and the party performing the O&M is not actually performing operational activity?
Well, that's a conundrum. Well,
That's a good question. I don't really have a straightforward answer for that. First and foremost, the entity that's performing operation and maintenance is generally under an agreement with EPA to do such. So if they're not performing O&M, meaning you have no data, my first recommendation would be to go to that entity and encourage them to collect the appropriate data. This is also a little, we have a lot of sites that are in, they're construction complete and not deleted. So I call them the Never Never Land sites. They're generally groundwater restoration activities. We have a lot of sites where we've gotten a majority of the groundwater contamination cleaned up, but we have low level contamination remaining. This can sometimes be a technology limitation. Perhaps it can just be a matrix diffusion issue. That's really, in order to get to site completion, and if you have a restoration objective, it's really a site-specific determination that the site team has to figure out what steps to take when you reach those situations. Sometimes there's polishing that might need to be done, some injections, et cetera. But again, that's really site-specific, so I can't really answer it on a generic question level. But, I would just recommend discussing it as a group and trying to figure out a path forward. And we'll be happy to talk to you in headquarters, too.
Okay, great. I have another multi-part question that came in online from Cincinnati, Ohio. And this first question that they ask is in reference to slide number 62 and 63. They state, can you clarify your discussion on slides 62 and 63 related to groundwater restoration and obtaining MCLs? I thought that you were suggesting that EPA is considering the MCLs to be, quote, performance standard, end quote, for groundwater restoration, whether or not the MCLs were specified in the ROD or other decision documents. You went on to say that this is applicable to sites with current or future drinking water use. How is EPA determining which sites may be used for drinking water in the future, especially if ICs are in place to restrict potable water use on site?
Ooh, okay. There is a groundwater policy that came out. I'm opening my internet email thing. Hold on. EPA put out a groundwater policy that talked about expectations for groundwater remediation. In general, EPA expects to return drinking water to beneficial use. So as a rule of thumb, if an aquifer is considered a current or future drinking water aquifer, then it is the expectation that EPA or the responsible party will restore that groundwater to beneficial use. Generally, we look at the EPA groundwater classification or states that have approved KISWIPs, but a very few states have approved KISWIPs, so a majority of the sites or the groundwaters at our sites generally fall into the restoration category. So in order to be quote-unquote protective by our interpretation of the NCP, we either restore groundwater to beneficial use, which is generally MCLs, or we have to go through a process of waiving that AROR through a technical and practicability waiver, which is a whole other course in itself. But say, for instance, we chose a remedy in 1983 and found out that, we decided to contain groundwater. We had a landfill cap, and we decided to contain groundwater within a mile radius outside of that landfill cap to prevent it from going into a river. What we would do at the time of site completion is we would look at the current and future uses of that aquifer, and if it was anticipated that that aquifer was considered a current and future drinking water aquifer either by a PISWIP or by EPA's classification, then in order to be protective by that definition, we would need to demonstrate that the MCLs have been met. In some we've had situations like this where we've gotten to the point where we've had these old decision documents where they did a containment remedy and sort of talked about the fact that it was not practicable to restore groundwater, and we've made them go back and modify their decision to apply an AROR waiver. But in general, the decision documents and their cleanup goals and the remedial action objectives need to meet the expectations of the program.
So if they don't meet the expectations of the program, then we're not ready to meet the site completion criteria. I don't know if that was clear. I hope it was.
Okay, great. Their second question asks, this question may be premature, but if obtaining NCLs for specific groundwater response actions, even if not at a cleanup level in the rod, is a precursor to site completion, will EPA consider partial site completion or deletion for the portions of the remedy that are complete? For example, for groundwater restoration that may include MNA.
Well, if the goal of monitored natural attenuation is MCL, then we would not consider the site complete until you met MCL. In the next section, I'm going to talk about deletions, and we do have partial deletions, and partial deletions allow us to remove parts of sites from the MPL while other long-term response activities are going on. So if you've restored, if you had a plume that was originally, I guess, 4 miles long and you were able to address it and it's now 1 mile long, you could, in theory, delete that part of the aquifer that was once contaminated no longer is. We don't really do that much. We generally, I would say, in the purposes of partial site completion, we don't do partial site completion, but we do delete parts of a site that have met cleanup goals before, say, the groundwater. So if you've done a source action and you've met your goals and we're still doing the groundwater restoration component, we can delete the soil and keep the groundwater on the MPL. But we'll talk about that in the next section.
Okay, and we have one more question that came in online. And that question asks, is coming from Denver, Colorado. They'd like to know, they have a landfill site where O&M is being conducted. The cleanup levels for groundwater have been met off-site but not on-site. Construction activities were complete about 10 years ago, but there is no PCOR or RACER. I'm pronouncing the acronym, but it's RACR.
Yep.
Is a PCOR needed? Does this seem like an appropriate time for an RACR?
So it has no, it sounds like it has no preliminary closeout report and no remedial action completion report, which is a RACER thing. I would ask who did the remedy. If the remedy was done, I know some sites in the Denver area have activities that were done not under CERCLA decision documents, so perhaps if there was no CERCLA decision document done at that site, it would be recommended that one be done, and then perhaps because you can't meet the construction completion criteria or the construction completion milestone unless you've got a decision document in general, especially if there's some long-term O&M. But I definitely think without a decision document, site completion might be premature. But again, that's probably a site-specific discussion that we can have.
Okay, great. I think with the interest of time that we're coming up a little bit past 3 p.m. Eastern, let's go ahead and move along with the presentation, resuming back on slide number 70.
All right. Let me fast forward my slide. Okay. So we're now on the last section, which is site deletion and partial deletion. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the deletion regulatory and policy requirements, and I'm going to talk about the Federal Register process. So we're going to move on to slide 72. What's new about the 2011 guidance? The 2000 guidance had a separate chapter on deletion and partial deletion. For just in order to streamline it, because really the procedures are the same, we put them in one chapter. The 2000 guidance required significant GPS mapping requirements for partial deletion. And we found this in implementation after that guidance came out to be a little bit problematic. And I'm not sure if it was just that the technology was not widely used, but we were getting maps or GPS coordinates that weren't even landing on the site that they were trying to partially delete. So in the interest of making it less burdensome, we decided to take the GPS mapping requirement out. The 2011 guidance discusses the deletion notices and provides a link to all the templates that can be used for the Federal Register notices. Also, in 2009, I believe, the delegation of authority was modified for EPA. It used to be that the regional administrator signed the notice of intent to delete.
But now the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, which is the office that we are located in, concurs on the notice of intent to delete and must concur on it before the regional administrator signs it. So that was a significant change, and as such, it was documented in the 2011 guidance. There's also, now that we're in the computer age, there is an electronic requirement to have a deletion docket in the federal docket management system where all the federal register notices are placed, and the guidance specifies those docket requirements. And then finally, it outlines the traditional and direct federal register rulemaking processes. And I'm going to go on to slide 73. So what is deletion or partial deletion? It is removal of site, or in the case of partial deletion, portion of a site from the national priorities list. One of the things that I want to mention right off the bat is the site completion milestone really is where the region has to sort of provide the burden of proof that site completion has been met. Once there is agreement, I think, between headquarters, perhaps the state at that point, although it's not really required during site completion, and the region that the site completion criteria has been met, deletion is predominantly really an administrative requirement of removing the site from the national priorities list. So there's not a lot of, I guess, site-specific information that's going to be new from what was in the site completion. The site completion the site completion milestone in the F-Corps really lays the baseline for the deletion and is really the heart of the deletion. So there's really no new information that's coming out of this. This is really just a EPA administrative requirement. So deletion, as I just alluded to before, the process generally begins at most sites when the final closeout report is signed. The deletion requirements include, generically, that the documentation of activities and decision-making at the site is complete, the activities conducted and documented are verified, and the public has an opportunity for notice and comment before the site is formally deleted from the MPL. So, partial deletions. In November of 1995, there was a Federal Register publication that came out based on some Superfund reforms that believed that partial deletion would spur redevelopment. So we modified the MPL to allow for deletion to happen at parts of the site. So EPA may now delete portions of an MPL site provided that the deletion criteria are met for those portions. Sometimes the portions that are deleted might be media specific. So you might just be doing soils. You may just decide to do an operable unit. You may decide to do a property. It really just matters on what you want to delete. But media or portions being deleted must be clearly delineated. Generally, we ask for a map when supporting the partial deletion. And the deletion actions for those portions of the site cannot interrupt ongoing removal or remedial activities at other portions of the site. So you can't delete soils and perhaps transfer it to another entity and have that entity remove all the monitoring well network for your groundwater restoration that's ongoing. So we want to make sure that any activity or any removal of a media from the MPL does not affect activities ongoing at other media and or areas. So moving on to slide 76, deletion criteria. The NCP states that the site may be deleted from the MPL when no response or further response is appropriate. And as we discussed in the last module, no response or no further response is generally documented by those site completion criteria. In addition, EPA must consult with the state in making this determination. The next slide, 77, is actually the deletion criteria from the NCP. So as it says here, EPA must determine in consultation with the state that one of the following criteria has been met. The responsible parties have implemented all response actions. EPA, under the fund, has implemented all response actions under CERCLA and no further response is appropriate, or you did a remedial investigation and showed that the releases do not pose a significant threat to human health or the environment, so no action is required. So for the first two, you've chosen a remedy, you've implemented it, and you've met your goals, and the third bullet is either another entity has done some activities, you've done removals, or you just did an RIFS at the site and found out that you had no risk, therefore you chose no action through a no action ROC. Next slide. As Jen alluded to in the construction completion module, there are some sites that were deleted from the MPL based on deferral to the RCRA program. The policies for the deferral to RCRA came out in the Federal Register first in 1995, and it was amended in 97 to include federal facility sites. And the reason behind this policy was that a bunch of sites in the late 80s and the early 90s were put on the MPL that were operating RCRA facilities, but RCRA was unable to address groundwater that was off-site, so CERCLA was going to be used to address that off-site groundwater. But when RCRA was amended by the Hazardous Solid Waste Amendments, I believe, in the early 90s, it allowed RCRA to address groundwater that was off-site. So this policy came out shortly after, and it was sort of an administrative way to clean up the MPL and prevent a duplication of effort. So for a lot of those sites that had an ongoing RCRA component that were being done under an enforceable order that could now address the CERCLA components under those orders, those sites were deferred to the RCRA program, so you didn't have the RCRA and CERCLA duplication of effort. Next slide, 79. The criteria for deletion based on deferral to RCRA are listed below, and as I said before, the CERCLA site is being addressed under RCRA corrective action permit. It's progressing adequately, and deletion would not disrupt CERCLA response action. We really only have, I'd say, a handful, maybe 10 sites that were deleted based on this deferral to RCRA, and we generally don't delete based on deferral to RCRA now just because so much CERCLA activity has happened at sites, and generally when we deferred to RCRA, it was very early in the process, so either we had just selected a remedy and haven't implemented it, or some early process even before then. So we generally don't see RCRA deferrals because a lot of our sites are in the construction, post-construction phase of the pipeline. Next slide is slide 80. So next I'm going to talk about deletion document preparation. This applies to both deletions and partial deletions. Whether you're deleting or partially deleting a site, you have to go through the Federal Register rulemaking process to do that. So the document preparation really is the same for both. So on slide 81, the deletion process includes obtaining a letter of concurrence from the state, compiling a deletion docket, preparing the notices, and obtaining headquarters review and concurrence. And I'll talk about those on the next slide. Slide 82, state concurrence. If the state is not in agreement, deletion cannot proceed, so states have a big role in deletion. If the state does not agree with the activities that were done, then the deletion cannot proceed. The NCDL requires that the state is given 30 days to comment on the draft deletion notices before publication. I'm going to go back a second to the FCOR, the final closeout report, which documents site completion. The state doesn't have a formal concurrence role in the final closeout report, but for purposes of making deletion a easier, more pleasurable experience, it'd be recommended that the state is given a heads up about EPA moving into that site completion and deletion part of the pipeline and given a chance to get to look at perhaps the final closeout report so that any issues can be resolved before you get to this deletion and the state concurrence is not problematic to obtain and then prevent you from deleting the site. Slide 83. A docket is required to support the action of taking a site off the MPL. So it's required that the region prepare a deletion docket containing all pertinent information supporting the deletion recommendation. I'm not sure how familiar everyone on the phone is, I know EPA folks are. An administrative record is generally assembled to support a record of decision at an MPL site. A deletion docket does not generally contain the administrative record. What the deletion docket contains is documents for the actual implementation of the remedy, so it really contains pertinent documents from remedial design through site completion. And per our guidance, the deletion docket should be available in the EPA regional office and local repositories by the site. And as I alluded to earlier, the deletion document docket, excuse me, must also be entered into the electronic federal docket management system, which is agency-wide for all Federal Register rules. Slide 84. Since the deletion docket, the components of the deletion docket really depend a lot on the RPM and the region, what the region think is appropriate for the public to make a decision on the deletion if they are to review the Federal Register notice and the supporting documentation. In our guidance, instead of telling folks that they had to put every document from remedial design through site completion in the docket, we really only gave some minimum requirements. So those are listed on the slide 84. A state concurrence letter is required in both the partial deletion and the deletion docket. The final closeout report is required in the deletion docket unless it's a RCRA deferral, because you might not have a final closeout report at that point. And for a partial deletion, since it's only for a part of the site, generally we don't have a final closeout report. So what we're looking for a partial deletion in lieu of a final closeout report is an RA report or a no-action ROD that shows that the parcels that you're proposing for deletion have met the site completion requirements, so they've met the record of decision cleanup levels. Also, for partial deletion, as I said before, in lieu of the GPS mapping requirements, we do require that the docket have a map. Slide 85. So the next slides might be a little administratively boring, but we'll go through them anyways. For the Federal Register, for the rulemaking process, there's really two ways of publishing a Federal Register notice. The first is a two-step rulemaking process. The first step is soliciting public comment, and after that comment, if the deletion is still appropriate, a second step to make the deletion effective. And then the direct final rulemaking process allows both the notice, soliciting comment, and the final deletion notice to be published on the same day, and the final deletion date is effective 60 days from that publication date unless comments are received and it's withdrawn. So it really depends on what your public involvement is going to be and whether or not you anticipate comments as to which route the region's going to go when they decide to delete. So on slide 86, for the EPA folks on the phone, this is a link to the online deletion and partial deletion templates. There are four templates for partial deletions and four for deletions. They're a little different based on whether you're doing the traditional two-step deletion process or you're doing the direct process. So it's pretty self-explanatory on there. I won't go into too much detail. On slide 87, as I talked about before, in the two-step process, you prepare your notice of intent to delete. You obtain headquarters concurrence, you publish the notice of intent to delete, and a local notice in the newspaper, you receive comments and address them as appropriate in a responsiveness summary, and then you publish a notice of deletion. I'm going to sort of breeze through these because I think it's a little boring for folks. For the NOI preparation, the notice of intent to delete provides the public with the EPA regional staff contact. Deletion criteria, which are in the templates directly from the NCP, and site-specific information, which is really coming from the F-4 or the RA report. The notice of intent to delete is sent to headquarters for review, and headquarters reviews it and then concurs on it. The concurrence from the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response has been delegated down to the Superfund office director. So the Superfund office director sends concurrence to the regional administrator, and that is necessary before the regional administrator signs the notice of intent to delete. And that has been in place since the end of fiscal year 2008. Slide 90. For obtaining headquarters concurrence, the notice of intent to delete is sent to the headquarters regional coordinator that every document besides the RA report in this training has gone through, and the headquarters deletion lead to provide comments on the draft notice of intent to delete. It's really important that the region and headquarters resolve all their issues, because headquarters is not going to provide concurrence unless everything meets the requirements for deletion. That's why I recommended during the final closeout report that you work closely with headquarters to resolve any issues in the document in demonstrating that the site completion criteria have been met, Because if it's done at that point, then this point, the headquarters concurrence is relatively painless. One of the other administrative checks that the headquarters concurrence does is it crosswalks with other site measures, specifically EPA's measures such as site-wide ready for anticipated use, construction complete, etc. It also verifies that the region required obtained state concurrence and that they completed the deletion docket. Next slide, 91. So publishing the notice of intent to delete, the RA, the regional administrator, signs the notice of intent after headquarters concurs. A deletion package is prepared in the region and sent to the Federal Register Office and headquarters for publication, and it's typically published 4 days after receipt. Slide 92. One of the other requirements from the NCP for the deletion is that not only is the notice of intent to delete a site published in the Federal Register for rulemaking to modify the national priorities list, but there's also a notice that goes in the local newspaper and is prepared generally by the EPA Community Involvement Coordinator that also, at a more local level, let the community around that site know of your intent to modify the MPL by either removing a part or the entire site. Also, the RPM, as we said before, the theme through this training is to notify the trustees when doing these activities. Slide 93. Sort of like a record of decision, when comments are received on an intent to delete a site, the region prepares a responsiveness summary for the comments as appropriate. It's sent to headquarters for review and comment. The responsive summary should be pointed in addressing the commenter's question related to deletion and really focus on verifying that the response activities indeed have been met and that it continues to be protective in order to continue to support the deletion activity if you're continuing to move that way, which generally folks are trying to. So, if a deletion is still appropriate after any comments, the notice of deletion is prepared, which once it's published in the Federal Register notice, it modifies the federal regulations national priorities list site and either partially deletes the site or takes it out of that list. And the document is sent to headquarters for review before it's published. It's signed by the RA, just like the notice of intent to delete, and goes in the Federal Register. And then slide 95 talks about the direct deletion process. I referred to this earlier. It's sort of considered to be streamlined in the fact that you only have to mail stuff to the Federal Register once, and you publish both the intent and the effective deletion date notices on the same day with an effective date 60 days after publication. The only issue with the direct deletion process, like any rulemaking process in the government, is if adverse comments are received during the comment period that question the validity of the deletion action, then the region has to prepare a withdrawal notice that pulls the effective date, that was the 60 days after the publication. Then they have to do a responsiveness summary, and then at that point, if the deletion is still appropriate, they then have to prepare a new notice of deletion, republish it in the Federal Register, and then that would be the new effective deletion date. So instead of doing two notices published on one day, they then have to do four notices published on different days. So really doing a direct deletion is going to probably be best for those NPL sites where you do not expect adverse comments or not a lot of community involvement in general at that phase of the pipeline. So slide 96 just shows the direct deletion process sort of when it goes according to plan on the top, and on the bottom is when it does not go according to plan. So it's a great tool if you don't expect comments, and it can be a real pain if you get comments because you end up having to prepare a lot of notices, getting the regional administrator to sign them and sending them down to headquarters for publication in a pretty tight time window. So moving on to slide 97. This talks about the preparation of the NOID and direct notice of deletion if you're doing the direct process. Both those documents go down to headquarters. Headquarters concurrence procedure is still the same. It has to happen before the notice of intent to delete is published, regardless which process you're going. So I'm going to sort of breeze through this slide. And slide 98 talks again
sort of what I've already talked about, that both notices are published at the same time in the Federal Register, and then talks about when the deletion becomes effective. If anyone has comments, when we get to the question section, I'm going to go quickly through this because they've already talked about most of it. Slide 99 talks about the withdrawal notice. If you were to get adverse comments on a direct rulemaking in the Federal Register, I've already talked about that again, so I'm going to skip this slide. Uh-oh. Okay, and then I think I'm done.
Jean? Yes. I apologize. If people are having problems with slide number 100, we're going to try to get that resolved, but it seems to have been okay in the downloaded version, so my apologies if the content on slide 100 is getting lost to some of you.
What was slide 100? Was that...
I'm assuming you guys revisit your case study or your site example.
It's the notice of deletion slide that we have to publish if we get a withdrawal notice. That's okay. I'll skip past it.
Okay. So that would bring us to slide number 101, at which point we're ready to break again for questions. I'll turn back to the phone line participants. If you are on the phones and you have any questions, please feel free to take yourself off of mute using this #6 command and identify yourself and organization to ask a question or make a comment. Okay. I do have two questions that have come in electronically, and those of you who are streaming the audio, you can continue to type up your questions or comments, but I would encourage you to do it quickly to make sure we can get them in. I'll come back to the phone lines, though, in a minute, just in case there are any other questions. Let's start with the two that we have. Is there someone on the phone who has a question?
Yeah, this is Holly Hadlock in Region 9.
Go ahead, Holly.
So this is just an overall guidance question. It's not specifically on the last chapter, and it's because I have to head out. I went online yesterday to try to get this guidance, and the first 5 pages were not readable. It was not a good PDF document. I ended up having to Google it and to, like, you know, the Hanford site or some other site, NPL site, they had it as an attachment. So, and there's a problem with accessing this guidance on the web.
Oh, that's interesting, Holly. We definitely haven't heard that.
Hold on, I'm pulling it up right now.
Yeah, we'll see. So that's the link even that this training sent you to, Holly?
I didn't go to a link about this training. I just independently yesterday was trying to get the closeout procedure, you know, May 2011 guidance. And after 15 minutes, you know, I wanted to print just a couple pages, couldn't do it, and even on the screen it was not in real print. It was, you know, just kind of electronic gobbledygook.
Yeah, we're looking at it right now and it's okay. I would suggest that you make sure that you are on the official link from the EPA webpage that's included in the page where you registered and signed on today for the training, and it'll be on one of the last slides that we're about to get to after questions. That link should be working fine unless we hear from other people they're having problems. We're looking at it okay right now, but...
Holly, I just emailed you the link.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, so hopefully that'll...
I just opened it, so it seems fine here. If it's a problem outside of here, we'll address it.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, if other folks had that problem, when you fill out the feedback at the end of the course, if you can note it, let us know. That'll tell us that we have some sort of web issue that somehow isn't affecting us here, but if we know that it's affecting others, we'll deal with it. So.
Okay, any other questions or comments on the phone? Okay, I'm going to start with some of the questions that came in online. And this first question comes in from New York. And they're asking, who performs the O&M after 30 years of O&M?
Depends what the lead of the site is. Are you referring to, is the person who's questioning asking about the generic 30-year O&M for landfills?
Yeah, I believe that's what they're referencing.
Well, in general, O&M is required in perpetuity for waste that's left in place, and as a rule of thumb, it would be either the federal facility PRP or the state. If there's a time requirement in a SFC or consent decree, I would recommend probably revisiting it, but I would have to defer to the attorneys on that.
So there's no statutory language that limits O&M to 30 years.
I know that a lot of the state rules and regs that for landfill closure generally defer to 30 years, but for Superfund, we generally don't hold that as a time when O&M stops.
Okay. Our next question also comes in from New York, and they ask, what if it is desired to remove part or all of the groundwater treatment plant? Who is financially responsible if it is desired to remove an underground storage tank that was part of an EPA-installed remediation system?
We install underground storage tanks? That's a good question. Generally, the entity that's running the plant is generally responsible for dismantling parts of it when that time comes. Generally, EPA should concur on that entity removing a part of a plant, especially if you haven't met a goal, because we don't like to see plants that don't exist anymore when we go out to do 5-year reviews. But I would say, as a rule of thumb, the entity responsible for the operation of that plant would be responsible for any removal or modifications to that plant.
Yeah, for fund lead sites, when we transfer a system from EPA to the state for O&M, we transfer ownership of equipment mm-hmm. as part of that deal, and the state becomes the owner of the equipment and materials associated with the remedy. And so O&M includes the responsibility of dismantling the system when the time comes, but it should be a joint decision.
There is a guidance on the post-construction website under O&M that's paying for remedy repairs. I don't know if you would call this a repair. I don't think you would call this a repair, but if you hypothetically had a repair for a site that was in O&M, there is a consultation with headquarters for discussing that type of activity.
Should we go to the slide that has links? One more question, please.
There is the slide 102 has the helpful website, and the second website is the post-construction completion website, which has things, there's different categories there. There's long-term response action, construction completion, deletion, 5-year reviews, operation and maintenance, the closeout procedures link are all under that website. So the guidances that I was just referring to could be found there under operation and maintenance.
Okay. The next question we have submitted online comes from San Diego, California, and they ask, if the UAO and attached statement of work stipulate preparation of interim and final RA reports, can that be ignored to comply with the new guidance?
That is probably a question for an attorney, of which I definitely am not one. I would not be inclined to think that our guidance would overwrite something in an enforcement agreement. I think that if you want to approach EPA on whether it's appropriate to change the documentation requirements in light of the guidance, that would be up to the settling parties for a particular site. So the guidance does not necessitate that enforcement agreements be opened to change the documentation requirements. We are okay with something still being called an interim final report or an interim RA report, if that's what your settlement document says. So I have a hard time believing that reopening a settlement document is worth everybody's time just for the label on a report. So.
Okay. Again, I don't see anything else in the online queue, so let's turn back and see if we have any last questions coming in from the phone line. Remember, it's #6 to unmute your line, and then feel free to identify yourself and organization before asking your question. Okay. Again, I don't hear anything, and I don't see any more in the online queue. So, Jen and Kate, if you guys want to go ahead and proceed on slide number 102, we can go ahead and move forward with closing things out today.
Okay, so as I said before, slide 102 has helpful websites.
the link here is for the first link for the closeout procedures that this guidance is based on. Just for reference, if anyone has any questions about the difference between the 2000 and the 2011, the 2000 guidance is also available on that link, on the closeout procedure, the post-construction link under the 2011 closeout procedures. The post-construction completion website, as I talked about before, has everything for LTRA, O&M, O&F, private reviews, deletions, partial deletions, construction completion. And then we also provided the remedial design remedial action website, which we really didn't cover a lot of stuff in this guidance, but some of the things on the RDRA website do sort of hit onto, hit a little bit on remedial action and remedial action completion a little bit. So we just wanted to let folks know that that website does exist and has a lot of guidance related to RDRA, different entities or delivery vehicles for doing such, et cetera. Let's see. And slide 103 is the contact information for Jed and I. Feel free to call us or email us with any questions or comments you have on the course. Anything that you might need clarification on, we'd be happy to talk to you.
Yeah, if you had site-specific issues that we kind of punted on in this arena, if you want to follow up with us, that's fine. It's obviously hard to answer a lot of site-specific issues on in a format like this. So.
Yeah, and we did. Jed and I were the co-authors that revised this guidance, so we're delivering, you know, we're going to try to offer this training semi-regularly in different venues. So if you have any comments on the delivery, we'd be happy to hear them, whether they're good or bad. We'll take both. I think that's all we have, Jean.
Okay, great. And then you guys don't have any other closing comments or statements to make before I move forward?
Nope.
Okay, excellent. So with that, I'm going to move everybody along to slide number 104 to begin the formal closeout for today's internet seminar. On slide number 104, which is our resources and feedback slide, you're going to find two links. The first one is a link to the additional resources page, which has not only the presentation materials that were covered today, but also links to the guidance documents and other resources that were pulled together for our training session today. So I would encourage you to take a look at that resources page and download the documents and guidance that were referenced. The second link that you'll find on slide 104 is a link to our short feedback form. As Jen and Kate mentioned, they're looking to get your input, so if you're running into problems either accessing the guidance or you're having other questions or have other comments about the training, things that were confusing or things that you thought went really well, please take a minute to fill out that feedback form and let them know what you thought for today's session. I do read each and every one of the responses that are submitted, and if you'd like to continue to see free online trainings like this delivered through Cluin, we rely heavily upon your feedback to let us know that it's a valuable service. For those of you that shared the line with multiple participants, once you submit feedback, there will be a link that will appear to let another person sit down and submit their own feedback form. For those of you that are looking to get credit for your participation today, we don't necessarily offer CEUs or PDHs for Cluin. However, a lot of our participants can still get credit from their accrediting institution if they save their registration email, they have a copy of the slides, and they submit feedback and get a confirmation email from us via feedback. So when you, or pardon me, a confirmation email for their feedback. So when you're filling out your feedback form, there's a box you can check, and we can send you a confirmation message that will at least verify that you indeed submitted feedback following the conclusion of today's seminar. Again, each person can fill out their own form and get their own feedback message if multiple people participated under one registration. As I mentioned earlier, today's session was recorded and will automatically be archived. So as soon as that recording is available, it usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, you will automatically get an email from me, which will give you the links to either download or replay the recording. And you're certainly welcome to go check out the over 428 archived seminars that we have available on the Cluin archived seminar page. You can even find us, we have a podcast in iTunes if you want to look for us. If you're not in a computer with internet access right now, all of those links are available on the seminar homepage. So if you save the emails or the reminders that you receive from me, if you go to the seminar homepage, you'll find links, again, both the links or resources page as well as the short feedback form. And then I believe that is the final slide in today's closeout session, but I will verbally remind you all if you haven't heard, we now have new ways to follow or connect with us for Cluin events and resources.
If you're a member of LinkedIn, you're on Facebook, or you use Twitter, you can look for EPA cleanup technology info and actually either follow, like, or actually join in on our LinkedIn group if you'd like to stay connected and receive the latest information about cleanup information and technology resources as soon as it becomes available. I want to extend my thanks to our organizers coming here from EPA's Technology Innovation Group, and I also want to extend my thanks to all of the participants. We had nearly 260 people from actually all over the world participating in today's session. I hope that you found today's seminar to be a valuable expenditure of your time. This will be the formal conclusion for our Internet seminar today. Thanks to you all. Have a great day.